Katharina Kurka, and I cordially welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical singing and voice, and I love to sing lots of contemporary and experimental music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website. And you can also subscribe there to my monthly newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about themes all around contemporary music and the human beings who are involved in this music scene. I share with you the behind the scenes, the insider knowledge, and most important, the human beings out of this world. I'm cooperating with NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, and yeah, I love receiving your letters, your messages, everything you tell me, and it's always also a pleasure for me when I meet you, when you come up to me and tell me, wow, I'm listening to your podcast, and those are very, very beautiful encounters for me. Also, this summer, we're gonna do the best of season again, because it's quite a success, actually, and it's a good way to kind of fill the summer for many reasons. And when I do the best of episodes, I look at all the download numbers, and then I decide from the episodes who rank really high to play them again. And yes, you like that, as I can see again in the downloads, and that is great. And in today's episode, we're gonna replay the interview with the composer and guitarist Michael Pissarro. Hello, Michael. It's so great that you're here and you take time for this interview with me.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Irene.
My first question for you is, how did you find your way into new music?
That's a good question. I'm going to have to think a bit. I listened to the radio a lot when I was growing up, and I was near Chicago when I starting around when I was 8 or 9. And at some point I discovered college radio, which in the 70s and 80s was kind of a bastion of unusual music. We also had in Chicago a very good radio station, I don't think it exists anymore, called WFMT, but I didn't learn about that until later. Somehow on the radio I started hearing avant-garde music, probably when I was in my teens, early teens or so. I remember hearing Penderecki and Cage. I don't think I was there, but I remember the Chicago Symphony did a concert for the bicentennial, which would have been 1776, in which I think the piece involved drawings by Cage of Thoreau, and this was broadcast on the radio, and of course it was a big, strange event with people walking out, and that excited me. I should say I was already very interested in free jazz, and that's an area, especially the AACM group, which was originated in Chicago, you know, Anthony Braxton, Mule Hall, Richard Abrams, Leo Smith, the Art Ensemble of Chicago, basically all started there. So that's probably the first avant-garde music that I actually heard. Having been interested in jazz, were these improvised, sometimes composed, concerts by members of the AACM.
So what the avant-garde music, would you say that you really liked it, or you were fascinated?
I loved it. Yeah. I think it happens often now too, that if you kind of grow up listening to the first music I liked, like most people my age, was rock music. And if you found your way already to Jimi Hendrix, you were already listening to a kind of avant-garde music. Still sounds like an avant-garde music. And I think really most people growing up in the U.S., certainly in my time, but probably still the case, that's how they find their way. But if you're lucky enough, like I was, to live in a place like Chicago where there was a thriving avant-garde scene, it wasn't the European scene at all. It was this very American, but it was truly avant-garde music, experimental music, then didn't take long to find out.
And how does this jazz experience come into, or does it still influence you in your way of working, composing?
Probably. I mean, the thing about AACM, they called it creative music, and its ties to jazz, there were still some clear ties to jazz, but They were also, I mean, in some cases, Joseph Jarman, who was one of the members of the art ensemble, was clearly influenced by Cage and tried to work with Cage at some point. Braxton also. So we're actually talking about a music that isn't quite jazz. It's not quite classical music. I mean, the word now is experimental music, and I think that was my formative experience, really. Because rather than just hearing it on the radio, I was seeing it played all the time. And you could say, in a way, it's an indeterminate music, too. Because even though there were compositions there, you know, improvisation was very much a part of the tradition at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think my music sounds like that very often, if at all. But the principles, I think, started there, for sure.
And what represents good new music for you?
I have no idea. it's always changing. I mean, I don't have a reliable set of even favorite recordings or favorite artists. I think I'm mostly drawn to things that are new to me and that challenge me. And so I'm more likely to be excited about something that might be even quite old, but that I know nothing about. So I don't have any kind of a fixed canon. It's usually the case if I liked something before, I probably still like it. But it's probably also then not part of my active listening. So,
what are the qualities you most appreciate in performers you work with?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. I may have to think a bit. I think I don't want to say there's any one quality, because what I appreciate most are the differences between the performers I work with. So if you sense that you're working with somebody who is in a way really themselves and have interesting differences in interpretation or in sound or in thinking, of course, that's what interests me. And it's not something anybody produces. So I'm not the kind of person who thinks anyone should try to be different. I think we already are different. Sometimes the music I write or the music I'm involved in seems to allow for these differences to emerge. That's really what excites me more than any particular quality. Of course, I would rather work with performers who want to engage in the music I'm doing. So I'm not somebody who looks for performers or would just ask somebody to do something out of the blue if I didn't feel that that was something they already wanted to engage in. So when it comes to the quality, it's this, there has to be something like that. There has to be some interest in working together. I mean, that's probably the ground, that's the base level of what makes it fun.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. You also are part of the Wandelweiser group. Mm-hmm. How would you describe Wandelweiser to somebody who might not have heard about it already?
Yeah, I think I've done this enough times that I try not to repeat myself, which is stupid, actually. But I would say, first and foremost, it's a group of friends. The strongest aspect of Wandelweiser for me is the ongoing sort of working together, experiencing music together, sharing interests. It's this kind of friendly atmosphere. That's what it is to me, you know, if I think internally. Of course, I'm aware that there were periods, especially early in Wandelweiser, where it would have been fair to make a kind of stylistic description. But I don't use that any longer because it really doesn't apply to Wandelweiser it is now. Because, in fact, it's not even a countable group. You could say there are a certain number of people that are published by Wandelweiser, but when I think about it, I think about all kinds of people who may or may not be composers, who may or may not be on a list, or they might be composers, but they're not on the list of people published. And so it's this is a larger network than I think anybody, even Antoine, has a grasp of. And it's still about the connections that you have with the people that are in it. So certainly my image of Vondelweiser is different than anybody else because I have a whole different set of people that I know and who I work with who are still somehow a part of that world.
So there is a lot of development in Vondelweiser?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's over 25 years old at this point, and just about everything in it has changed. It was initially a very small group, and I think within a few years, it consolidated around maybe four, five, six people, actually. There might have been more sort of in the periphery, but from my experience, say 25 years ago, I was dealing mainly with the same four or five people all the time and following very, very closely their work. And we had so much overlap in what we were interested in at that point. That's a fairly unique thing. And happily, everybody kind of grows in their own direction. It was already evident then, but now I don't think you could mistake one person's music for another. But as that has fanned out, all kinds of other people have come in the interstices or do things that maybe 25 years ago nobody would have thought of doing. And so it becomes basically impossible to describe as a musical style. I think it's an experimental music. I mean, Antoine and I were talking about this the other day, and I was thinking it's a different generation of experimental music that followed from what I perceived as a lull in this kind of avant-garde music. My friend Volker Strabel, writing about American experimental music in the 80s, he wrote an article called The Death of the Avant-Garde, of the American Avant-Garde, which didn't mean all the composers died. Cage was still alive, and Christian Wolff, and most of that period, Feldman and so forth, Pauline Oliveros. Most of those people were still around, but as a music that seemed to have any cultural currency, it had almost disappeared. When I was studying, nobody talked about Cage except as a philosopher. Certainly, his music wasn't played except by maybe one professor I had who would play it in class. You felt like you had to deal with Cage, but I also got the sense, it was a tangible sense, that people were relieved not to have to deal with these very challenging and open-ended questions that they had to, you know, that occurred as a result of experimental music of that period. So when I was studying, it's, you know, people thought much more about, well, how do we write music that will appeal to a large audience? You know, in retrospect, it's easy to say, well, it was a complete failure. That never happened. At the time, it didn't, you know, it's like that was the main direction things were headed. So it's interesting that when Vondelweiser started in 92 or 93, my standpoint was these must be about the only people interested in this music. I know I'm wrong about that, but that's how it felt. And I think that gap is actually a feature of, in retrospect, it seems to me that's a feature of what made us who we were, because it was a sense not that you were just continuing where someone had left off, but it had to be reinvented.
Sounds great. How do your friends, family, colleagues, and audiences react to the sort of music you make, and how do you deal with their reactions?
It's all over the map. I mean, I have family members who can't relate at all to what I do, and it's not. I try not to make it their problem. You know, anybody doing avant-garde music probably knows this experience, that at some point your taste develops or heads in a certain direction that is so far from the mainstream that people who don't engage seriously with music might never come anywhere close to that. And it seems like it comes from Mars or something like that. I've certainly had that, my share of those reactions from family and old friends and so forth. Rather astoundingly, however, there is a good size audience for this music. It's not always located in one place. I mean, certainly in LA, it's now not unusual to have an experimental music concert with 500 seats that sells out. That happens.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's not everyone by any means, but certainly, if there's a well-known name, Meredith Monk, when she played in L.A., you couldn't get a ticket to that. The Julius Eastman concerts are selling really well. I mean, these kind of larger events. But even we did kind of Vondelweiser-related concert in Red Cat, which is a CalArts kind of a theater that holds a couple hundred, and that sold out. So, I mean, that can happen. So some places, I'm just saying, some places there's a recognizable audience, but I think that this larger audience that exists everywhere in the world, most of us are everywhere, almost everywhere, most of us have a sense, a dim sense of this, and it's now not that unusual, certainly when I'm talking in various places, like in the U.S., most people I talk to already know about Vondelweiser. Of course, I'm not talking to just people on the street. That test I haven't done yet. But people who are already in some kind of contemporary music world. So that's there's a lot less explaining to do now than there used to be.
That's very amazing. Do you think there are prejudices against new music? And if so, how do you want to see things change? Or what are you doing to bring change in these attitudes?
Clearly, most of the people I deal with are not prejudiced against new music. To be honest, I don't think much about expanding the audience. I don't actually think you can change people's prejudices through any kind of argumentation. It seems to be experience that does that. And so the interesting question to me is more, how can I remain, or two things actually, how can I remain open to other experiences myself? What does that feel like? You know, what is it that draws me to a concert of Persian music? When it's, you know, it's a foreign language to me, it's a music I didn't grow up with, and yet what kinds of inner resistances do I have to overcome to actually go to the concert? So of course I think about that in reverse. And it makes me, well, in terms of programming and putting on concerts where I live, it makes me think, well, how do we first of all make it possible for people to find out that this is happening? But even more importantly, how do we learn to welcome anybody who comes to the performance? That's much trickier than I think most people think it is. So you can think of yourself as a very open and welcoming person, but I think that, again, having experienced this a bit in the reverse, all kinds of subtle codes are often given off by people who make music that already suggest who kind of belongs there and who doesn't. I mean, it might be as simple as how people dress. I work on this festival in the summer called the Dog Star Orchestra, and we had a concert in a kind of not the nicest location in the city. It was a gallery. It's a place that we've used quite often. And it's a good place for a performance, but you kind of have to drive not into a really dangerous, but a kind of abandoned part of the city. And most people who are part of that scene would know that you don't wear a suit. As it turned out, we had a guest who came to this concert in a suit. And he'd been brought by a friend. And I'm sure that's what this guy normally wears to concerts, because he mostly goes to the L.A. Phil. I think he might have even been an administrator at the L.A. Phil. In any case, I thought, okay, this is a classic circumstance of somebody expecting it to be a certain way, and they come there and they feel like an idiot because everybody else is in T-shirts and jeans, and they're the one. And in fact, the guy came up to me afterwards and apologized for wearing his suit. But I don't think he felt out of place. I mean, I think at first it was a bit of a shock to be, you know, a 50-year-old guy and come into a room with 25-year-old people in all various states of fashion. And it's but that's a code, right? And we see it in reverse all the time with new music concerts. And so I think there are actually many things like that. For me, that's the more, and that exists in the sonic world as well. That's, for me, the more interesting question about how people find out about the music and how they get introduced to it. And I think there are really a lot of questions like that.
you're a person who is very busy teaching, writing, and so I'm curious, what is your approach to, I call it, time management? Do you have any advice, or do you have like a daily routine?
I don't really have a daily routine. My approach changed most radically when we had a child 20 years ago, my wife and I, and we decided we would sort of split responsibilities in terms of dealing with babies and small child and everything. So anybody who's lived in a childless life for a while and had a child probably knows that your whole life time management changes radically. That's probably the biggest impact, far more than trying to juggle. But one thing I learned from that is that I could do things in less time than I thought I needed. And it's a very strange thing with the creative process, is that there's maybe a kind of mythology that you take all the time you need and you wait for a good idea to come, and eventually, you know, it will. And I'm all for patience. But I also started to realize that if I had an hour to do something and I wanted to do something, there's this kind of auto-suggestion. Your body just starts preparing itself mentally for, okay, I have this hour to work and I'd better be able to work. And I don't think I was conscious of that, but at some point I realized that when it came to this thinking about time, I was already ready, you know? I think a lot happens that way. So I'm the kind of person who does kind of schedule a day, and I don't do it because I feel like I need to regiment myself so much as mental preparation. I think actually the other thing, probably more important than that, is that I've been very, very lucky to design my life in a way that I feel like the activities flow together. So I don't try to do too much. When I'm traveling, I'm not really writing music. When I'm teaching, I have days in which I teach, and then I have days in which I have nothing else to do. So it's, but the teaching itself, let's say, the work with students on music I care about, that's also a creative process. And I don't feel like that's robbing time from writing music. I still have plenty of time to write music. And if I did something I didn't like, I'd be far more conscious of the energy needed to come back into composition. Whereas I don't really feel that much. I feel like creative energy, the more you use it, the more you have, I guess is the best way to put it.
And what are you grateful for today?
I think I'm grateful for what I sense, not just musically but politically, is the emergence of a kind of hope for the future. I think it's very easy right now to be distraught, disheartened, pessimistic about just take any area, you know, politics, since I live in the U.S., you'd almost have to be crazy to be optimistic about politics, but that's only one point of view. I mean, we have Trump, who I hate, of course, that's easy to say, but we have to keep in mind that Bernie Sanders probably could have beaten Trump and, in fact, was almost the Democratic nominee. He would have been by far the furthest left nominee the U.S. had ever had. We were so close to that. I mean, if somebody had told me that 10 years ago, I flat out would not have believed it. I wouldn't have believed that an idiot like Trump could be elected, although we've had many idiots as presidents. So I think these things, you know, situations are always mixed. And what started to emerge politically is a sense that, well, if this could happen, then something else could happen. And so the feeling that there's possibilities, I think we have to work towards that, but I think a lot of people realize this. Same thing with environmental issues. It's very easy to get completely depressed about the environmental future. You could even say it's logical to be depressed about it, because we're talking about such enormous, uncontrollable forces. But it clearly doesn't do any good. You have to find a way to imagine a future, even if it doesn't seem entirely realistic. The emergence of this kind of thinking for me is, that's what I'm most thankful for right now. I think it absolutely applies to the art world. I mean, experimental music, if you look at it, I mean, even your questions are at the edge of this, is nearly impossible to do. You're hardly well paid for it. It's not the world's most popular music. It's hard to support culturally. Everything about it seems to kind of work against it. And yet, as I was saying, and I really believe this, it's a larger field than it's ever been. So if something is happening there where people say, I want to do this because it's possible. And I don't care if others think it's unlikely or it's not going to be successful. What draws me to it is this sense that there's more possibility there than there is elsewhere. So I'm thankful for that.
Who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, or what inspires you?
Boy, I don't know who's played the greatest role in shaping me. That's a collection. There is no one person. For sure, there's no one person. I think what inspires me most is seeing, you know, so I'm 56, so I think I'm allowed to say this, just allowed to say this now, is to see much younger people experimenting. Because so much can happen when that process begins. And I know already that there's no good reason to do it, other than there's no good practical reason to do it. And so when people, you know, when I see students or younger people who seemingly on their own decided that they want to try something that at least they've never thought or they've never heard of, that seems nearly impossible to imagine, or that just seems to come from left field or whatever, that's the most inspiring thing to me. Of course I'm inspired by, you know, wisdom coming from whatever direction, parallel, you know, people much older, you know, Greek philosophy and so forth. But there's a sense in which you need, in order for those things to be resonant for you in any given time, you need to feel that there's something alive in the world that you're actually in. I don't think I'm going to look back to some fantastic cultural explosion and just be able to find the life in it without any exposure to that in my own time. And so I think in any time we need more the sense that something worthwhile is actually happening than we need to know that there are other worthwhile things had happened. So I'm really very much on the lookout for those things. You know, I don't just wait for them to come to me. I'm actively searching out. So where in the emerging sort of art, music, whatever world is something happening that shocks me or surprises me or makes me think I never dreamed something like that was possible?
And what does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in the music business? And how do you keep true to yourself?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's my word for it, really, is just honesty. I have tried, I think, relatively successfully to discipline myself to only do things I really want to do. and that was especially true when it comes to writing music. And takes a discipline, because I think we're always filled by other people with ideas about what we should do, what's been done, what's impressive, even very well-meaning friends, for all the so-called right reasons, can try to influence you. Oh, you should be doing more of this, or I liked it better when you did this, and we all live with that. And this capacity to at some point say, but what actually do I really want to do? The kind of separating out all the things you could do or that seem like they might bring you something you want outside of the music itself, to kind of pare that away and find out what it is that drives you to make that particular piece or play in a particular way. That's, I would say for me, that's the critical component of the process of writing music for me, is to sort that out. And I think in my case, it comes, any good idea just comes from an impulse. An impulse is not a logical extension of something before. It's not something just bestowed upon you from somebody else. It's something you feel. I feel it in my body, actually. This could be interesting. And whatever that is, it's like an electric impulse, actually. Whatever that is will not always enunciate itself clearly. It won't tell me exactly what it wants. And so this being true to that is what I care most about. And it's, what is it? What do I really want from this thing? It can be shocking. I mean, there's some relationship here to the unconscious, I think. And I really believe the unconscious exists. And this, you know, is Jung and Freud and so forth, Lacan, so many people seem to understand. This is an immense reservoir of seemingly sort of chaotic things that can emerge at any one time. So probably an impulse has something to do with that. It probably also has something to do with external circumstances that move in certain ways. Maybe they're not obvious things. It could just be, you know, you put a different, you get new windows in your house and the light coming in your room is a little different. It can be something that small. It can be something that you notice when you're playing that you never noticed before. So I'm not necessarily talking about a huge thing. I'm talking about something like a disturbance or that you just feel, oh, this is not what I expected. This is different, or this is interesting, or I need to deal with this. So this is the thing I feel I have to be true to. I have no sense that I have to be stylistically consistent. I think that's actually an artificial construction. We can do it in retrospect with people who are dead. We have all their work. We might discover other works that change the picture a little bit, but people work to make that picture from the outside. I don't think the artist has to concern themselves with that.
And what drives you forward? Do you have a vision?
Yes. I mean, I think it's this sense of something emerging from the work I and others are doing. I mean, Vondelweiser is a good name for that. There are probably many other names for that, but you start to see that you're working not just alone, obviously, but you're working in a field. And it's not like a field in the sense of you specialize in neurology and that's a field of medicine. It's a field that's in its own way populated, but can't be defined as such as a category. So this might mean there are all kinds of things in that field which aren't directly composition related. They might be artistic works or people you know or something you read in a poem somewhere. But this collective entity, watching this grow, is the thing that drives me forward.
We already arrived at the last question, and this is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Yeah, that's something I think about all the time, usually directed to a very specific person. Mm-hmm. Because if anything, I've learned that I don't want to mold artists to be similar. For me, that's actually the greatest danger of any kind of advice, mm-hmm. is that you're consciously or subconsciously shaping things to go already in your direction. Certainly, that's on some level unavoidable. Everybody who believes strongly in what they do, almost without consciously doing it, is starting to persuade other people. But to the extent that I can be conscious of this, my only advice is really that each artist has to find their own path. I mean, it's such a cliche, but it's absolutely true. And maybe the next part of that is to be suspicious of things where you feel too heavily persuaded to do something that that you don't want to do. There's never any reason for an artist to do something they don't want to do. And I know it goes against most educational models, which are, you know, in my case, having, you know, fairly rigid classical training, four-part harmony, counterpoint. At some point I had to learn Western musical history. That's part of who I am. I'm glad I did it. But I don't think that's what makes anyone a better or worse artist. It's interesting on some level. But the idea that somehow there's any particular way in which one becomes a worthwhile artist, I actually reject. And so but there's still, you know, you're always trapped in this contradiction. Even by saying an artist should find their own way, I'm already influencing them. So maybe the thing is to try to grasp that, to try to grasp that these tensions really exist, you know, that it's not just a question of one's out alone in a field freely picking whatever flower one sees. One's always kind of being shoved in a certain direction and has to say, but do I want to be in this direction? Maybe thank you for pointing this out to me, but now comes the time at which I have to really think, you know, somebody I trust has made me look at this area, but maybe I still have to learn how to turn my head. Advice is difficult in that way. What I'll say is that when I have students, I try to be very patient with them and I spend a long time, not hours, but weeks, years sometimes, trying to find out what do I think they actually want to do. And this takes a while because everything that comes to me at first is what I want them to do. And this period of waiting for whatever it is that I think they want to do to emerge, which will express itself in hundreds of sort of small ways, that's usually what I'm waiting for. And I think we should learn how to wait for that with ourselves, in ourselves. You know, that same process of, okay, this will come to me.
Thank you so much for taking your time with this interview. And I think it is very inspiring. And thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this interview with Michael Pissarro. I hope it could inspire you. And now I'm looking forward to your ideas and suggestions. Please write me through Facebook. I'm looking forward to meet you. Many thanks that you were listening to me today. I hope that you liked it and it inspired you. And I would be very grateful if you could take some time to give this podcast and me a good valuation on iTunes. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and I see you next time. Yours, Irene.